Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia Research Center and the M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services are hosting a second annual health fair focused on Alzheimer's disease and dementia awareness and prevention. That's happening on Saturday. The fair is a collaborative project with USU faculty who have expertise in psychology, aging, neuroscience, nutrition, caregiving, and more. The event is open to the public. It will be at the Taggart Student Center on the USU Logan campus, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. And today we are going to talk with Joanne Shantz, who's clinical neuropsychologist, professor in the Department of Psychology, and founder of the fair. Joanne Shantz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. We also bring in the keynote speaker, Dr. Nick Frost, assistant professor of cognitive neurology in the Department of Neurology at the University of Utah. Nick Frost, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
John Chance, I should also mention you're endowed chair of the M. Eccles Jones College of Education and principal on the Cache Valley study, Cache County Memory Study, which people will be familiar with. I think people, researchers are still using data from that study.
Yes, that was a study that started in 1995, and we were able to enroll 90% of the permanent residents age 65 and older in Cache County, Utah. And we followed them until roughly 2009. Individuals with dementia, we followed until 2013. So it's very rare to have a full population-based study. We were able to follow this cohort and learn about a number of things in terms of genetics for Alzheimer's disease, as well as other various risk factors.
Nick Frost, tell me a little bit about your research. What do you study?
Yeah, so I'm at the University of Utah, and I came here in 2021, and I really wear a couple of different hats at the university. So on the one hand, clinically, I see patients with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, and am involved in identifying patients who would benefit from amyloid removal therapies and treating patients with Alzheimer's disease. And then I run a systems neuroscience lab, really focused on understanding at the circuit level how the brain encodes different types of information that are relevant to individuals with Alzheimer's disease and other types of neuropsychiatric disease. And then understand how the brain changes in different models of disease and how that affects how information can be processed and stored and used during behavior.
So, Dr. Shantz, tell me just in brief about the fair. What you're trying to accomplish here?
So the health fair is meant to provide information to the public about modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline in late life. And it follows from a trend that's occurring in the literature where we have multi-domain interventions that are being conducted in the U.S. as well as elsewhere in the world. And we are focusing on things that people can do to kind of reduce their risk. So one would be, for example, engaging in cognitively stimulating activities, getting their hearing checked, and getting an intervention like hearing aids if they're having some difficulty hearing. We're looking at their health. So some chronic conditions like hypertension, hyperlipidemia in midlife especially are associated with increased risk. Healthy eating, the mind diet, and engaging in physical activities, reducing stress, enhancing sleep. All of these things are things that we can work on, and they've been shown to be associated with better outcomes and reducing one's risk for developing dementia. So we're doing a health fair. We have 11 booths that people can attend. And if you join the study, which is the Prevent Alzheimer's for Life study, we will do assessments and track your data over time. If you don't wish to join the study, you are also welcome to join the health fair and just engage in as much as you'd like or as little as you'd like.
Tell me a little bit more about the study. What do you want people to do, and then how long is it going to last? What are people going to do in the study?
Okay, so when people come into the study, they'll get a brief bit of information about Alzheimer's disease and modifiable risk factors. They'll be asked to do a brief cognitive screen, like two tests. That'll take about 15 minutes. And then they'll fill out a number of questionnaires that will examine how they're doing on day-to-day kind of activities, as well as what their own perception is of their cognitive status. If they have not had a hearing evaluation, they'll be asked to do a brief hearing screen. If they, they'll also be getting their weight, their height to calculate BMI. We're also going to get some measurements like hip circumference, waist circumference. We'll get blood pressure checks. We're going to assess where they are on eating healthy foods, and they'll get a score from that so they can track that over time. We'll get an indication of how physically active they are. They'll do what's called a grip strength to assess how strong their grip is, and a task that's called timed up and go to see how quickly that they typically might walk, which is associated with like frailty and overall cognitive resilience. We'll check their balance and their fall risk. And then also have them complete some questionnaires on perceived stress, a brief depression screen, a brief anxiety screen. We'll get a sense of whether they are having sleep disturbance, insomnia. And for those of who have chronic pain, which is pain that lasts for 3 months or more, there's a booth related to that. And the last booth is it's called our Living Well booth, and that deals with social connectedness and how one can engage in, social well-being, which is associated with reduced risk for dementia and cognitive decline.
No,
So people can join the study, and we will have an annual health fair, as you mentioned, and so once a year, they can come back and we can track their progress on these modifiable risk factors. We also have a website that is promotes various research data that talks about each of these different domains and some suggestions, such as in the mind diet domain, what some recipes are that are, quote, mind diet friendly.
So the study is Prevent Alzheimer's for Life, for PALS. What do you hope to gain from the study? What do you hope to learn?
So we hope to learn one is whether a format such as a health fair is effective in terms of getting information out about modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. So will if we hold the fair, will people come and will they come consistently? Two, will they continue to engage or start with some of these lifestyle changes to modify their risk for developing dementia? Three, we hope to expand on the study in future years, perhaps collect some biological samples, such as blood samples or saliva samples, that will allow us to do some more intricate kinds of study and to also, address other research kinds of questions to look at potentially gene environment interactions. And we also hope to expand to where we can actually do some more in-depth cognitive evaluations to then determine if someone is experiencing substantial memory loss or cognitive decline, and suggest that they follow up with their healthcare provider.
Dr. Frost, I want to throw this to you. I want to get Dr. Shantz's ideas on this as well. But first, Dr. Frost, I'm not sure if I have had the kind of the right understanding of this. Probably not. But I know I'm representative of some part of the population. Kind of what I've come to this w with is sort of a an emphasis on the genetic aspect of this. Sort of with a little bit of dread, hoping that I don't come up a loser in the genetic roulette wheel, right? In terms of dementia. But I think what you're emphasizing here with this fair and your studies is I can reduce my risk factors. So I guess my question to you is that true? I can really reduce risk factors, and even if I'm genetically predisposed, I can at least push it off or maybe prevent it altogether?
Tom, I think that's exactly correct, and I think that's really important. And I always just this is a little bit tongue in cheek, but I always sort of joke that there's four reasons why we get Alzheimer's disease, and the first two are really old age and bad luck. And we are, as Americans, we're living longer than we ever have before, and so we all want to live these long and healthy lives, and we're doing a really good job of it because we just have made all these medical breakthroughs in other fields, and it just increases the odds that we're going to live long enough to get Alzheimer's disease and some of these related dementias. And but we know that this is modified by genetics, and so there's a couple of very rare forms of Alzheimer's disease where certain proteins that are involved in secreting beta amyloid are altered, and those cause these very severe forms of Alzheimer's disease that tend to present in folks in their 40s, and so that's usually not what we see. And in terms of the genetics that are driving most of the Alzheimer's disease in America and in my clinic, we have this protein called APOE. It comes in three flavors, and one is protective. It's relatively rare. One is kind of the normal form, which most people have, and then there's a less common form of APOE called APOE4, which raises the risk of Alzheimer's disease, so that you're more likely to get Alzheimer's disease at an earlier age. But regardless of the genetics, we know that doing the things that Joanne has been talking about, eating a healthy diet, living a healthy lifestyle, where people are sort of active both physically but also sort of cognitively, really does delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease regardless of the genetics. And I think that's really important, particularly because Utah is sort of special demographically in that Utah has one of the smallest populations of people over the age of 65, but there's still almost 400,000 people who are elderly in Utah, and that equates to roughly 38,000 or 40,000 people with Alzheimer's disease, which is really a small town. So the longer we can put that off, the better, because there's only three cognitive neurologists in Utah also.
Oh, well, really? Wow. So, Dr. Chance, I was reading about a study. The National Institute on Aging, I'll just read this, that showed that people who engage in and adhere to at least four of five specified behaviors have a 60% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And I think some of those were ones that you were mentioning. Physical activity, not smoking, consuming alcohol in light to moderate levels, eating high quality diet, participating in cognitively stimulating activities. That was very helpful for me to read that. 60% reduction if you engage in four of those five activities.
Yeah, that is a great study that looked at two cohorts out of the Chicago area, and it just shows the benefits and the power that people can who are engaging in some of these activities do show a reduction in risk. Now, that's not a clinical trial. These were observational studies, so of course you can't rule out some other confounding factors, but there have been clinical trials that the first one, I believe, was out of Finland, where they conducted a randomized controlled trial. They enrolled people into a multi-domain intervention, and they had the control group, and those who were engaged in the multi-domain intervention actually scored better on neuropsychological tests, which was their outcome measure.
Dr. Frost, want to as we go along, concentrate on prevention, right, and reducing risk factors. That's what the fair is all about. But I wonder, once a person has, I guess, early dementia, are there mitigating drugs? Can dementia be reversed?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So we have really three types of once patients see me, they already have Alzheimer's disease generally. And so we have essentially three types of interventions that we can offer patients. The first, and I think that probably the most important, is really, again, these sort of lifestyle modifications, because we know that eating healthy slows down the rate of progression, even in people who have biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. And we know that exercise also is super important. And that's something that people can just go home and do. In terms of pharmaceutics, we have really two types of medications. And the first type have been around for a long time. So we have these drugs like Aricept or donepezil, which work by replacing a neurotransmitter in the brain that's lost early on in the course of the disease. Honestly, especially in early Alzheimer's disease, it doesn't tend to do very much. They're much more likely to have a benefit when people have progressed a little bit further and are having delusions or hallucinations and other issues like that. And so it's super exciting now that we have these new monoclonal antibodies, which are a disease modifying. And so for the first time, we can actually slow down the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And the two drugs really are lecanemab or Leqembi, and then donanemab and or Kisunla. Lecanemab was FDA approved in 2023, and then donanemab was FDA approved just last year. And they both are monoclonal antibodies that go into the brain, and they bind to this protein beta amyloid that aggregates in the brain, and they remove the beta amyloid with the help of the immune system. And in both cases, they seem to slow down in large, very nicely done clinical trials. They seem to slow down the progression of the disease by about 30%. But if you look within those patients, there are patients that do very well, and there are patients who do less well. And so it looks like if we catch people very early in the course of the disease, we A, have more time to slow down progression, but B, we can slow down progression by a much more significant amount. And so really getting into a sort of a memory care clinic or a cognitive neurology clinic early on is really important, because the sooner we start these drugs, the better.
That is hopeful that some of this can be reversed even when it starts. I assume some can't be reversed, probably.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, and we talk about this a lot, because in general, we don't think that we are reversing any of the damage that has occurred. And really, what we are trying to do is slow down the progression, right? And so my goal when I start a patient on therapy is that next year, or the year after, or the year after that, they will look as close to how they look now as possible. But they won't necessarily reverse some of the early changes in cognition that they initially came to the clinic with.
Dr. Shantz, just one more question before we go to break. under the topic of prevention, now I assume, there's no too early, right? We want people to be doing these good behaviors, all through their life. But what about, what if I'm like 80? Is there benefit for me to start with some of these behaviors just to prevent?
Yeah, I always think you're right. It's best if you start early in life, and build up as much reserve as possible. And we often say it's important also to look at midlife. But many of us are just really busy, and we'll just put off till late life. Like, well, I don't have to worry about Alzheimer's disease yet. I'm too busy to deal with it. But I don't think it's ever too late to start. So even just starting slowly with physical activity and incorporating that in your life is the best thing. So no need to go get a gym membership, for example, but just taking walks around the neighborhood, or trying more different recipes that are healthy, and working on de-stressing your life. All of these things can be incorporated. It's just making them a priority and then folding them into your life so you're more likely to follow through and follow up with it.
Let's take a break. When we come back, much more. We're talking about Alzheimer's and other dementias, and we're highlighting the fair, which is going to be coming up on Saturday, Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia Research Center and M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services are hosting their second annual health fair focused on Alzheimer's disease and dementia awareness and prevention. It's happening on Saturday, starts at 10 a.m., goes to 3:30 p.m., and they're encouraging you, if you would like, to help out with a study that Dr. Shantz is heading up as well. Everybody's invited, and it's open to the public. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're highlighting the Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia Awareness and Prevention Fair that is happening on Saturday. It's open to the public's Taggart Student Center on the OSU campus in Logan from 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. We are talking with keynote speaker for the fair, Dr. Nick Frost, Assistant Professor of Cognitive Neurology in the Department of Neurology at the University of Utah, and with Joanne Shantz, who is Clinical Neuropsychologist, Professor in the Department of Psychology, founder of the Alzheimer's Prevention Health Fair. So, Dr. Frost, I'm reading from the Utah State Plan for regarding Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. They gave some stats here. They are saying approximately 1 in 9 individuals over the age of 65, or about 34,000 Utahns, has Alzheimer's disease. I'm not sure exactly, but that's a couple of years ago. And they were predicting by 2025, this year, the number is expected to increase to 42,000. I wonder just overall, do you have national trends? What are the trends for Alzheimer's disease? Increasing, decreasing, remaining stable?
Yeah, we all know that Alzheimer's disease is an extremely important and growing health problem. And the reason for this is our population is growing, both nationally, but also here in Utah. And Alzheimer's disease is sort of an age-related disease. So as our population ages, we have proportionally more people over the age of 65 and proportionally more people who are over the age of 80, and we know that these populations are highly likely to get Alzheimer's disease. And so, like you said, something like 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 individuals over the age of 65 has Alzheimer's disease, and specifically those are people who are having symptoms too. And we know that the actual rate is even higher as people get older. And so if you were to take 100 individuals at the age of 80 and do autopsies on them, we would find that about 40 of them, even in cognitively normal people, have Alzheimer's disease pathology. And this is because, beta amyloid and then tau are two proteins that aggregate in the brains of individuals. And beta amyloid aggregates, and then around 5 or 10 years later, tau accumulates. And then it's only about 10 years later that people start having symptoms. And so usually the disease has been going on for quite a long time before people even know.
Dr. Shantz, what are you mentioned a whole host of things, behavior modifications that we can do. What are the biggest risk factors to developing Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I think the biggest risk factor, as Nick had mentioned, is old age. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that we can do about that. But there's also, I think, physical health is very important in terms of some of the risks. So things like hypertension, hyperlipidemia. If someone had a prior head injury, for example, that's also a risk factor. So there are many things that, one's health that you can do to try to reduce your overall risk. And some of these things are like physical activity, which anything that's good for your heart, like cardiovascular health, will also be helpful in terms of Alzheimer's risk. There are also some things in terms of the cognitively stimulating realm. So individuals who've had high years of formal education are generally at lower risk. And we can't necessarily say that, having, completed your doctorate, for example, is going to prevent you from developing Alzheimer's disease. And there are a number of other confounding factors like socioeconomic status. But we have seen that individuals who are engaged in cognitively stimulating activities who have stimulated their brain over their lifespan, for instance, have built up this cognitive or neural reserve that might be able to withstand some of the damage of Alzheimer's disease, and so may delay showing the symptoms until, you know, several years down the road.
Dr. Frost, I wonder if you could also comment on that. Cognitively stimulating activities, like if you're in the habit of doing that, can that help?
I think two things. The three things that I really focus on in my clinic are really things along the lines of the cognitively stimulating activities, the healthy diet, and exercising a lot. And really what I focus on in terms of the cognitively stimulating activities is I cannot emphasize enough how important social engagement is. You know, our retired folk are at particular risk of becoming socially isolated and withdrawing because they've retired. They no longer have to go to work and talk to people. And so it becomes much easier to just hang out at home and not see anybody for days. And we know that our brain has this remarkable power to sort of heal itself and form new connections between neurons that repair the circuits and keep them working in their most optimal fashion. But that plasticity is really driven by social interaction and these neurotransmitters like dopamine and oxytocin and glutamate that are released during social interaction. And so I tell people to go out and take a walk with their spouse or their partner or other members of the community. And that can sort of kill two birds with one stone because now you're sort of engaged in physical exercise and you're talking to the person next to you and you should be sort of walking at this pace where you're just slightly out of breath and so it becomes hard to finish your sentences. And then you're doing the cardiovascular exercise and you are sort of promoting a healthy lifestyle that's, I think, easier to maintain than, again, like buying a gym membership and going to a gym. We all know that everybody does that every New Year's. They make a resolution. You know, lose 5 pounds and go to the gym. And so gym memberships go up in January and then they go back down in February. And we don't want that. We want people to do things that they can really sort of maintain and sustain for an entire lifetime.
Or buy exercise equipment. You buy a new piece every January and then it never gets used, right?
And it accumulates in the garage and now you can't even use your garage anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Chance, I wonder if you could follow up on this. This really struck me. Not only, Dr. Frost just said, not only cognitive stimulation, but social stimulation, social engagement is important.
Yeah. In addition to stimulating activities and stimulating your brain when you're engaged socially, you can also benefit just in terms of getting that support. So people who might be feeling blue, lonely, somewhat isolated, just getting out and speaking with other individuals and sharing, you know, common experiences. And that just helps in terms of your level of well-being, which may help to reduce your risk of developing depression and reduce the experience of stressful activities. So getting socially engaged and maintaining that is critically important, and you can see it from multiple different perspectives.
Pulling up again this state plan, and they're reminding us of functions that can be affected by dementia. So I'll start with Dr. Frost on this. A whole list. Memory, as we know, right? Reasoning, judgment, problem solving, learning and concentration, emotions and personality, motor skills, visual perception, behavior, language, communication. All of that can be affected by dementia. Obviously, this is affecting the brain. I think part of what you study, Dr. Frost, is how this happens, right? How modifications happen in the brain.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, the brain is this most amazing organ in the body, right? And it does so many things that we take for granted. And I think importantly, different parts of the brain do different things, right? And so we have compartmentalized function within the brain. And so there's parts of the brain that are involved in language. There's parts of the brain that are involved in memory. There's parts of the brain that are specifically involved in helping me drive from my house to the store and then come back, right? And so spatial navigation. And then there's also parts of the brain that help us regulate our mood and our behavior. And these are all things that we do throughout our entire life without thinking about them. And then when something goes wrong with a particular area of the brain, we start having difficulty with that particular cognitive domain. And so I think this becomes important because remember, dementia is many different things, right? And so there's many different types of insult that can cause cognitive impairment. And these range from traumatic brain injuries to strokes to different types of neurodegenerative diseases. And so depending on what process you have or what type of what part of the brain is being affected first, we may see different symptoms. And so Alzheimer's disease in particular, we tend to develop pathology that affects our ability to engage in spatial navigation or formations of new memories at the earliest stages of the disease. And so we see these deficits in short-term memory where people start having difficulty remembering conversations that they had earlier that day, or remembering upcoming appointments, or remembering where they put certain objects like their phone or their keys, or they go to the mall and they can't remember where they put their car. And as the disease spreads, it starts to affect other areas of the brain, and so we ha start having difficulty with other cognitive domains. And there's other neurodegenerative diseases, for instance, frontotemporal dementia. That tends to start either in language areas, in which case you get a primary progressive aphasia, or in more frontal areas of the brain that are involved in regulation of mood and behavior. And so you may develop impulsive or erratic behaviors or changes in social interactions. And these can often occur many years before people have difficulty with memory per se. And so that can also be very difficult for caregivers and loved ones because it's a change in personality and the person is no longer the person that they were before. But I think it's important to remember that as we develop deficits in certain domains, other parts of the brain are still working completely normally. And so many of the functions of the brain are still working. And so I think often I send people to neuropsychologists specifically, not only to identify their specific deficits, but also to sort of reemphasize their strengths and point out the things that haven't changed yet.
Dr. Chance, anything you'd like to comment on that general topic before we go on to the next one?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary of the progression of Alzheimer's disease and contrasting that with frontotemporal dementia. And I think the one thing that I'll just pick up on that Nick mentioned is like, getting a sense of where one is in terms of their deficits as well as their strengths is critically important. So, if you have a deficit in learning new information, for example, what can you do about it? Well, there are some other areas cognitively that are still strengths and are still intact, if you will. So, one of these areas might be executive functioning. So, if you have adequate executive functioning, you may be able to develop strategies to compensate for the memory loss. So you can't remember your new appointments, for example. Well, come up with a strategy or have someone help you to develop a strategy that can help you compensate, whether it be a memory book, a list, or using, your smartphone to develop a schedule and then putting in a reminder so that you are checking your calendar, for example, every day. So it's really important to get a sense of what these cognitive strengths are to help you deal with, some of the deficits that you may be experiencing early on.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment. We are talking with Joanne Shantz, clinical neuropsychologist, professor in the Department of Psychology, and founder of the Alzheimer's Prevention Health Fair. That's what we're talking about. The second annual fair is coming up on Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. And we're also talking with keynote speaker for the fair. He'll be giving that on Saturday, Dr. Nick Frost, assistant professor of cognitive neurology in the Department of Neurology at the University of Utah. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. There is a health fair coming up on Saturday on the USU campus. This is the Alzheimer's Prevention Health Fair, second annual, sponsored by the Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia Research Center and the M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. That is Saturday, as I mentioned, in the Taggart Student Center on the USU campus, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. We're talking with Dr. Nick Frost, who's the keynote speaker. He's assistant professor of cognitive neurology in the Department of Neurology at the University of Utah. And we're also talking with Joanne Shantz, who is a clinical neuropsychologist, professor in the Department of Psychology and founder of the Alzheimer's Prevention Health Fair. Dr. Frost, let me direct this to you first. If I or a loved one is has developed troubling symptoms, maybe some memory loss or whatever it might be, worried this might be dementia, we're not sure, I guess evaluation is what to do?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And, you know, usually the way that the process starts is patients will bring it up with their primary care doctor as sort of a first step. They will basically come into their doctor and say, I'm having some trouble with memory. And often, the primary care doctor is either doing yearly screens or this will prompt a screen at that point where they'll do one of these sort of quick cognitive assessments like a MoCA or a mini mental status exam or a SLUMS test, which is just a sort of a one-page series of questions that covers sort of a variety of cognitive domains that are particularly affected. Generally, it focused on Alzheimer's disease, to be honest. They're most sensitive for Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, if that test is normal, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't something going on, that doesn't rule out an incipient neurodegenerative process. But if it's abnormal, that should prompt us seeing that patient as quickly as possible in cognitive neurology. And then when I see people, you know, because there's a variety of different processes that can cause cognitive impairment. And remember, you know, I basically see three kinds of patients. Some are completely normal. Some have a little bit of cognitive impairment, and some have more. And remember, the brain is the biggest it will ever be when we turn 43, and it gets a little bit smaller every year after that. And so we all notice changes in how our mind is working. And so processing speed is a little bit slower as we get older, but this is sort of in exchange. We have more accumulated wisdom and knowledge. But some people have noticed a little bit more change than would be expected for their age. And when they come to my clinic, I can also detect it. We see it on our testing, maybe it's not affecting their day-to-day activity. We call that mild cognitive impairment. And, you know, at that point, people who have mild cognitive impairment, depending on the etiology, sometimes they stay the same, sometimes they progress over time. If they progress over time, we start to notice that it's more difficult to do those things that people need to do to live independently. And we call that dementia. There's a mild and a moderate and severe level of dementia. That just means more things are more difficult. And our goal is really to prevent or slow people from getting to that stage, right? And so because there's a number of etiologies that can cause this cognitive decline, we look for a number of things. And so everybody who I see is going to get brain imaging in the form of an MRI. This allows us to look for structural lesions like tumors or hydrocephalus or other things. We can also see atrophy in some cases, but we can also see strokes and other things that can be causing some cognitive issues. I also usually get a metabolic PET scan, which is different from an MRI in that we're looking not at structure of the brain, but the function of the brain. And so we can look for areas of the brain where neurons are working as well as they should or where they're not working as well as they should. But we also do a number of screens looking at either vitamins that can be deficient or things like thyroid function that are really important and very easy for us to intervene on, right? If someone has a thyroid problem, that will cause immense cognitive problems, but it's also very easy to fix because we can either supplement the hormone that's not being produced or reduce the thyroid function if there's too much hormone being produced. And then I think, again, because we do have disease modifying therapy for Alzheimer's disease, we try to get biomarker confirmation of abnormal amyloid pathology as quickly as possible, because that's necessary for starting some of these disease modifying therapies like lecanemab or donanemab.
Dr. Chance, what are the best starting points? If you want your loved one to get an evaluation, where do you turn?
That's a great question. So I think, as Nick mentioned, it's good to start out with your primary care provider. Get a sense of what's going on. Your primary care provider knows the person's medical history, and kind of can see if there's been a change, and start to monitor, perhaps doing some of those cognitive screening tests early on and look for change. I think that's one of the biggest things is what you hear from family members and loved ones. Well, this person has always been this way. They've always been somewhat absent-minded and a little forgetful. If that's been stable across time, then perhaps that's just the way they are. Maybe there's a blip when there's increased stress or lack of sleep, but that's not going to be a substantial change. Now, if things change, like the person who is absent-minded is starting to get even more forgetful, and it's alarming or it's concerning, and you're seeing new episodes of forgetfulness, like things they've always remembered, like birthdays, things that they've celebrated. Then it's kind of time to take a look and to get more information. I know there's a lot of anxiety related to getting cognitive testing or getting an evaluation, but it is also critically important because there can be some things that could be causing the cognitive changes that is not Alzheimer's disease. It could be something medically going on.
Yeah, I think that's important to you. There is a lot of kind of vague fear, right? And that sometimes people just kind of use that and repress it. And let's not even look into this because the potential is too scary to think about. But maybe it's not dementia. Maybe it's not Alzheimer's.
Right. And that would be important. There can be things like depression that influences one's cognitive abilities. Sleep disturbance, it just reduces your overall level of attention, concentration, speed of information processing. Some of those things that where you feel like, wow, I'm just not as sharp as I used to be. But this does not necessarily mean that this is a the start of a neurodegenerative process.
Dr. Prost, if you do receive a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, what do you tell the patient and their family members? How best to adapt and live with the condition? I guess maybe lengthen out the onset or delay the onset. How best to adapt and live with this?
Yeah, I think there's a it's a range. It depends on the patient to a certain degree. I think patients who for whom amyloid removal therapies are available for, I generally I'm evangelical about them. I think that they're very effective and can help us prevent progression of the disease to the later stages. But they're not for everybody, and I think there's a risk versus benefit calculation that has to occur for every individual. And so there's some folks who just aren't going to start the drugs. But there's still a lot of things that we can do for those individuals. And so I think, again, we have all of these modifiable risk factors that we can intervene on, because often there are things that people aren't doing that they could be doing more of. But I think we have a sort of a multidisciplinary team, and so often people will meet with physical therapy or speech therapy, our neuropsychologists and our social worker. And then I think it's really important, and I think Joanne mentioned this earlier, there's support groups that are critically important, I think, both for the patient but also for caregivers, to sort of see how other people are dealing with these disorders as they progress over time.
Dr. Chance, yes. Let's at least mention briefly here the caregivers. I was reading another this state plan had this fact. In Utah, nearly half of all adults provide unpaid care to loved ones, 22% of them providing care to someone with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's and other dementias is especially painful, right, for their caregivers, usually family members, because it can affect personality and memory.
Yes, that's right. The family members and the caregivers will see the person change, and they may not recognize this person any longer. Where they're like, oh, this is different. This is a like a, dealing with a different person, but that individual is still there. And we're finding that in a study that we published with our dementia progression study from the Cache County project, is that individual caregivers who had a closer relationship with their loved one or the care recipient actually showed a slower rate of decline. And what we're thinking that's related to is the caregiver knows the care recipient. They can kind of adapt the care recipient's environment. They can keep that person engaged in some level of activity and the things that they enjoyed doing. And so maintaining that kind of involvement in life and that social, kind of activity is very helpful. We find that early on, if people are engaged in cognitively stimulating activities, the care recipient, they actually show a slower rate of decline. This doesn't, it's not maintained throughout the course of dementia, but especially important in the mild stages of dementia. Maintaining good nutrition is also important. Good protein intake is associated with slower progression amongst people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So even after a diagnosis of dementia, it is important for to create an environment that will help the person with dementia maintain as much of their functioning as possible, but also important to recognize that the caregiver is doing these things, is trying to provide support for their loved one, and they need support as well. So I think one of the most important things is the caregiver often will not take care of themselves and will not engage in self-care because they're so busy caring for others in their lives. So some of these things that caregivers need to do for their loved ones, they also need to do for themselves.
Just have a couple of minutes left, so about a minute each. I'll start with Dr. Frost and then go to Dr. Chance. Just remind us again some of the top risk factors that people can actually, manage behaviors and reduce risk.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the first thing I will say is that this starts very early in life. You can be reducing your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease almost from childhood, although, we don't necessarily want our children, worrying about developing Alzheimer's disease. But, so we know that educational attainment builds resilience. And then we know that as people go through their sort of middle years, being physically active, eating a healthy diet, leading a healthy lifestyle, those are probably the most important things that we can do. And those are all non-pharmaceutical things, right? You don't need to take a drug to eat better. But if you develop diabetes, the lifestyle modifications don't always work. And so treating the diabetes with the help of your primary care doctor is really important. If you develop high cholesterol, again, the lifestyle modifications don't always work. Treating the high cholesterol with the help of your primary care doctor is going to be really important. If you develop high blood pressure, again, staying active and doing all these lifestyle modifications doesn't always prevent it. It helps. But if you have high blood pressure, you should treat your high blood pressure with the help of your primary care doctor. And I think those are really the most important things is, essentially things that are healthy for your heart are going to be healthy for your brain. And we want people to sort of live a long and enjoyable life. And I think usually, as long as that's in sort of the healthy lifestyle category, that's going to promote brain health for a long time.
Dr. Chance, we have about 30 seconds to give you the last word here. What's the big takeaway you'd like people to take away from this conversation?
So the big takeaway is there are a number of things that you can do to reduce your risk of developing dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And a lot of these things are also going to enhance your well-being, your enjoyment of life, being physically active, cognitively active, socially engaged, and taking care of your overall health.
Well, we've been highlighting, we'll highlight again here, there's an Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia Awareness and Prevention Fair. It's happening on Saturday at the Taggart Student Center on the OSU Logan campus, 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. As a part of that, Dr. Chance is heading up a Prevent Alzheimer's for Life study, a bunch of things that you can participate in there at the fair or just come to the fair. And that is happening on Saturday. We've been talking with keynote speaker Dr. Nick Frost, assistant professor of cognitive neurology in the Department of Neurology at the University of Utah. Dr. Frost, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And Dr. Joanne Shantz is clinical neuropsychologist, professor in Department of Psychology, and founder of the Alzheimer's Prevention Health Fair. Dr. Shantz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.